This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedures Subteam Track 3, String Contention, Objections, and Disputes, held on the 12th of December, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you're only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for a recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Robin Gross. Please begin.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. This is Robin Gross speaking. Can you hear me okay? Can you hear me?
And Robin, audio sounds good on this side.
Okay, thanks. Okay, well, let's get started with a quick review of our agenda. We'll do updates to SOIs and then a plenary update. And then we will very briefly review our work plan through March and then get into the meat of the issues today, concluding our review of the comment on community applications and getting into switching gears and getting into the community comment on the objections that we had received, and then any other business. So unless there are any comments or questions on the agenda. Okay, not seeing any hands or hearing any voices. Let's get right into it. Okay, so is there anyone who would like to update their statement of interest? Now would be a good time to do that. Okay, doesn't look like we've got anyone today for that. Moving on to agenda item number 3, a plenary update. Looks like on today's call, we are fortunate to have both of our plenary co-chairs, Cheryl and Jeff. I'm not really sure which one of you or both of you would like to give us an update regarding the plenary work. Okay, I see Cheryl's got her hand up. Please, Cheryl, go ahead. Thanks.
Thanks, Robin. Cheryl Langdon off the record, and it was about 24 hours ago, in fact, exactly 24 hours ago, that we had our last plenary meeting. The primary topic for our meeting yesterday, then, was to review and analyse the types of new GTLDs, the discussions have gone so far on the types, and, of course, that had a number of comments and conversations that would have affected the thinking for members of this work track. So with that, we finished by giving ourselves all a little bit of homework to do on the list, and also to have a second part of our homework, which was to look at the predictability framework that we've been working on now for some time, and to, in particular, come up with any case or use case scenarios that we can apply to the predictability framework and see if we've got something that's a robust enough model for use as we intended. So if anyone has a scenario or a use case that we can do that over the next week or so, we'd appreciate that coming to the list as well. That's pretty well it. Thank you very much, Robin. Back to you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Is there anyone who has any questions or comments for Cheryl? Okay, it doesn't look like it. So we can move forward in the agenda. Can we get a the calendar, the work plan up on screen that we shared in the email. Just very briefly, I wanted to quickly review the work plan that we've agreed on so we all know sort of where we are and where we're headed. Okay, so as you can see now, we're well into the deliberation phase, and the next 2 months or so, we'll be focusing on coalescing our opinions, and we need to finalize and refine our report in early March, and then present our reports to the plenary March 9th. So just sort of wanted to make sure we're all keeping an eye on our where we are in our overall work track plan. Anybody had any questions or comments on this? All right, not seeing any. We can go forward. Thanks. Agenda item number 5. We will conclude our review of the community comments, 2 on the community applications. And we only had a couple questions left over from last time that we didn't quite get to. So it really shouldn't take us too long today to, I think, wrap up community comment on community applications. So number 3.3.4, the question that went out, were the rights of communities, e.g. freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of religion, and principle of non-discrimination, infringed by the new GTLD program committee? Please provide specific examples. It looks like the comment that we received back from the registry stakeholder group, the BRG, and the affiliates was that they didn't believe rights of the communities had been infringed. Does anybody want to weigh in on that topic here now, agree or disagree with that comment, or have anything else to say on this particular question? And again, if you're wondering what number we're looking at here, it's 3.3.4 on the themes document that's on our screen. Okay, I see Anne's got her hand up. Please, Anne, go ahead.
Thank you, Robin. It is not a specific comment on the responses to the question, but relates to a comment from yesterday's plenary meeting. I think when a representative from Iran asked a question about whether there could be a community of drug traffickers on that call, someone, maybe it was Avery and Cheryl, then noted this, of course, that would be an illegal activity and one couldn't really establish a community for an illegal purpose. But I think Karen also commented during that call that there was, and again, trying to respond to Caruso's concern, that there was a general sense within our work track 3 that there should be community applications should serve the public interest. And the reason I raise that here is that we refer here to freedom of association and freedom of speech. And with respect to the general idea that community applications should serve the public interest, I hope that what we're all talking about is very broadly interpreted, because there is a public interest in freedom of association. And I don't know if we are going to try to set about some sort of definition of public interest in relation to community applications, but I did note Karen's comment about that in the plenary yesterday, and I just want to go on record as saying, you know, freedom of association is in the public interest, as is pointed out by this question, and I don't think ICANN should be making content judgments about communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne, for that comment. Would anyone else like to weigh in on this point? I see in the chat that Jim Prendergast has asked, does anyone have any idea on when the CPE will be completed? I think that should inform our work. And Jamie Baxter replies, Jim, there has still been no further announcement or publishing of the FTI findings since Scope 1 and 2 have been delivered to ICANN. Not sure what the delay is or what the plan timing is of this being released. I concur this is most important for ICANN to get this out for further discussion by this group and others. Okay, so we're waiting for that report. That will certainly be helpful. Did anybody else want to weigh in? I see in the chat, Don Nevitt says, I agree with Anne, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. Okay. Anne, did you want to get back in? I see your hand is up. If it is perhaps still up, or maybe it's up again. I'm not sure which. Okay, I'm not hearing anyone. Okay, there, it's gone down. All right, so anything else on 3.3.4? Okay, so let's go on to 3.3.5. Besides the CPE, are there other aspects of the new GTLD program related to communities that should be considered in a more holistic fashion? For instance, in the 2012 round, the claim to support a community is largely only relevant when resolving string contention. Do you think community applications should be structured and or evaluated differently than other applications? Okay, does anybody want to jump in on this? Looking at some of the comments that came in. Okay, I see Jamie Baxter has his hand up. Why don't I go to you first? Please, Jamie, go ahead.
Sure. Thanks, Rama and Jamie Baxter, for the record. Not directly related to the question you just asked, but I think we may have skipped over this discussion in the last call with respect to cost. In the applicant guidebook, there was a published number as to what it would do potentially cost to have a community priority evaluation conducted. Ultimately, that cost came in at more than double what was published in the guidebook. I'm not sure if that was related to poor management of hiring the people and understanding what the scope was going to be and what that ultimately would come in at as a price tag. But it seems as though if there is information published in the guidebook, even though it's listed as an approximate cost, more than double an approximate cost is truly a concern of ours, and that is something that I believe, should be willing to chip in and cover some of the costs, because it was up to them to determine what that cost was going to be, and have published in the guidebook. So something that I don't think we discussed the last time, and I feel like it's an important issue.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I think you're right in the sense costs are very important, and I know we've discussed it in previous calls. I'm not sure it was the exact last call, but I know others have raised that point that costs are something that we need to have a better understanding of, maybe get a little bit of control over, and also be included in the evaluation and the analysis of the overall effectiveness and usefulness of the program. So I hear you that it is something that we need to be talking about. Does anyone else want to weigh in on that point? All right. Well, I don't see any hands or hear any voices. Looking at some of the CC2 comment that came in under this 3.3.5, the registry stakeholder group and affiliates address potential implications of the model for subsequent procedures. For example, continuous application periods or a system that did not involve rounds. So I thought this was an interesting idea, sort of a continuous application period, which might help to obviate some of the pent-up demand that somebody gets. created through the round system. Anybody have any thoughts on the suggestion or anything, any other of the points that came in under 3.3.5, the structuring of community applications differently from other applications? Okay, I see Greg has his hand up, and then Gigi. Please, Greg, go ahead.
Thanks. It's Greg Chatton for the record. I think overall, you know, noting the comment that's in there from the VTLD consortium and NABP, demonstrating that registrants are bona fide members of the community seems to me kind of the minimum set, and that if community applications from the community are going to be given priority or other incentives, it's important to be able to kind of both review and have certain assurances regarding the business model or management model on a going forward basis. For that, you know, it's obviously a tricky road to hoe because you don't want to get into granular content oversight by ICANN. But on the other hand, holding a registry that has been given a priority or other incentives to the business model that got them there seems to be only common sense. Otherwise, it's really an invitation for gaming. So I think it's important that if we do define things as community applications, that the that there be a way to ascertain and truly that not only is the community a legitimate community where a lot of rabbit holes were dug, but also that the community registry will be run differently than if it were just a generic registry. So just like there's a Spec 13 and certain different contours for brand registries, there should also be different contours for community registries. And if those contours aren't attractive to the applicant, they can just apply as a regular applicant, without the community incentives, so that and thus not get any priority, but then be able to do whatever they want. But you can't have your cake and eat it too. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Okay, next in the queue we have Gigi. Gigi, please go ahead.
Thank you. Greg took a lot of the words right out of my mouth. There's been concerns about gaming with community applications, and as Greg said, providing a structure that would require some level of verification would seem to me to attract only those that are actually out to represent a bona fide community. And therefore, it seems to make sense as part of the community application structure and process. So I think Greg pretty much covered the rationale there.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Gigi. I see Steve Chan has his hand up. Steve, please go.
Thanks, Robin. This is Steve Chan from staff, and I would want to attempt to try to provide some clarity about how community applications were considered in the 2012 round. So whether or not the community application was involved in community priority evaluation, the community requirements, or I guess the registration requirements that they put into their application those things that they put into their application submission, they ended up getting translated into specification 12. So there is actually a specification for community commitments, I guess, is a way to put it. So that's one part of it. They absolutely get integrated into the agreement. So I guess part of the question for 335 is, you know, whether or not the community application should be evaluated in some respects, because if it doesn't go through CPE, per the GNSO guidance, the claims to support a community are essentially taken on trust unless there is CPE. And then those claims to support community are then translated into specification 12. I think I have that right, but hopefully that provides clarity. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. I see Gigi has her hand up again. Please, Gigi, go.
Thank you. Yes, that is helpful. But I as I recall, Spec 12 was largely something that's not carved in stone or something that is evaluated. I could be wrong about that, but I didn't have the sense that community registry operators are actually held to upholding some standard for representing the community. And likewise, I think those comments do support an evaluation that would apply to all community applicants and not just in case of contention. Thank you.
Thank you, Gigi. Alan Greenberg, please go ahead.
Thank you. Maybe I missed part of our discussion. At this point in the last round, if there was no contention, then the application was not evaluated under the CPE, nor was there any benefit or privileges or anything associated with being a CPE, with being a community application. So if there was no contention for one reason or another, then it was rather moot. And yes, the requirements did go into, the specification did go into 12, but they could be changed afterwards. But there was there's nothing really which makes a community application special. If in this coming process we decide that the pricing is different or some other rules are different, then it becomes an issue of making sure that they don't change the environment under which they were granted the TLD or anything else. But as long as there's no benefit to being a community once you've decided there's no contention for one reason or another, then I don't really see the need to put any special requirements on them. I personally believe there should be benefits to being a community, and therefore everyone should go through the evaluation, but we need to define what those benefits are first. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Did anyone else want to get in the queue on community applications in 3.3.5 here? Okay, if not, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. And we'll go back to objections and the CC2 review of objections. So if we could get those on the screen, that would be really helpful. Okay. So let me just start with the first one, 3.1.1. Do you think that the policy recommendations 2, 3, 6, and 20, require any modifications? And if so, what would you suggest? And a quick reminder to folks as to what recommendations 2, 3, 6, 12, and 20 are. 2 says that strings must not be confusingly similar to an existing top-level domain or reserve name. 3 recommends that strings must not infringe the existing legal rights of others that are recognized or enforceable under generally accepted and internationally recognized principles of law. 6 recommends that strings must not be contrary to generally accepted legal norms relating to morality and public order that are recognized under international principles of law. 12 says a dispute resolution and challenge processes must be established prior to the start of the process. And 20 recommends an application will be rejected if an expert panel determines that there is substantial opposition to it from a significant portion of the community to which the string may be explicitly or implicitly targeted. Okay, so that's a quick recap as to what recommendations 2, 3, 6, 12, and 20 say. So it's a pretty broad question. Do you think that the policy recommendations require any modifications? And if so, what would you suggest? Okay, before we get into the CC2 comment, does anybody want to get in the queue first and have any comments on these recommendations? All right, well, I don't see any hands or voices, so let's just look at what some of the suggestions were that came in and see what people think about those. Okay, so into Nominet, the Registry Stakeholder Group, BRG, and affiliates believe that the existing recommendations do not need to be revised, though this does not preclude changing the implementation. Another expert excerpt, Nominet recommends, says the recommendations look reasonable, but it would be interesting to see how in practice they are implemented in a way which still gives certainty to prospective applicants. Reasonable people can disagree as to whether one string is confusingly similar to another and what is generally acceptable legal norm relating to morality and public order. Okay. Does anybody have any comments on these? It looks like the Registry Stakeholder Group, the BRG, and affiliates suggest a minor change to Recommendation 20, in particular clarifying what constitutes a significant portion of the community. It did seem like there was a little bit of ambiguity and uncertainty as to what that means, a significant portion of the community, and I think that came up in a number of applications. Anybody want to weigh in on that? Think it's a good idea or a bad idea to come up with some kind of a clarification as to what constitutes a significant portion of the community? Okay. I do see Jamie Baxter. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. Jamie Baxter for the record. It is an interesting question because it appears when looking at, what has happened in the prior round, is significant portion because only organizations are really counted in a sense, or given any merit in defining community support, it really does sort of raise the question, is it a significant portion of the community's supporting organization? Is it a significant portion of the people who are associated with that community? So it really does, it's an important question that really has to be looked at a little bit closer, but those are things that sort of jump into my mind as to the misunderstanding of what significant portion could have meant to people who were applying for community applications.
Th- Thanks, Jamie. Yeah, is a significant portion 5%, 30%, 50%, not depending upon which segment of the community gets measured. That could be parsed a lot of different ways. Anybody else want to weigh in on this? Okay, Anne, please go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Robin. I agree there probably is some clarification needed. Two things I would note is that, you know, where there's some type of organization, you know, organizations have, if a corporation has bylaws or, you know, a membership corporation, or depending upon the form of the organization, there are officers or directors who are authorized to act. So you get, you know, if there's a determination, I guess, made by that organization, you know, does the organization then, having that authority conferred upon them, do they at that point in time, you know, represent a significant part of the community? And then where you're not talking about a long-standing organization, whether you are talking about something that's, you know, not in a corporate form or whatever, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem, because there may be, you know, a legitimate basis for representing a significant part of the community that is attempting to step into a void, and that one could see that once the TLD was established as a community TLD, that folks would potentially flock to it as well. So there's quite a balancing act there on significant representation of a community. And I don't know how we flesh out more factors, but I think the panelists probably need more guidance.
Thanks, Anne. Jamie, please go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. Jamie Baxter for the Record. Another thing to add on to what Anne has raised is really the issue of how do you count a community that is invisible, in a sense, and can it be relied on more the organizations that are visible for that population of people, or are they going to be subjected to having to make themselves visible in an environment that could be unsafe for them? So, you know, these are just additional questions that really sort of go to the issue of significant support and how that gets tabulated or calculated. And, you know, it really does need to be much more predictable, because as an applicant, if you're reading the guidebook and that is the only line that you're given, there is so many ways it can be interpreted, and to increase the predictability for the applicant, it really does need to get drilled down a little bit. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, anybody else want to get in the queue on this point? If not, okay, let's move down to the next one, 3.1.2. Do you believe that those recommendations which led to the establishment of the string confusion, legal rights, limited public interest, and community objections grounds were implemented effectively and in the spirit of the original policy recommendations? If no, please provide examples. Okay, so we had a comment back from Jenny Kskow, BC, the Registry Stakeholder Group, the BRG, and affiliates, which suggested that string confusion needs to be improved. One of the comments made on that point came in from the BC. It says, while the objection process in the first round was generally effective. One notable flaw was the inconsistency in panel decisions for string confusion objections. In order to address this flaw for the subsequent round, we support the publication by ICANN of more detailed and objective criteria for determining string similarity, as well as a broader appeals mechanism for challenging any decisions that are perceived to fall outside of such criteria. Okay, so does anyone want to weigh in on this point, 3.1.2, and the implementation of these recommendations? Improvements to string confusions, for example. One comment that came in from the registry stakeholder group, BRG and affiliates, said that the panel would issue a single determination that identified which applications would be in contention. Any outcome that resulted in indirect contention would be explained as part of the panel's response. A limited appeals process would be available to both the objectors and the respondents to handle any perceived inconsistencies. Ayla commented that string confusion proved to be problematic, and the potential for differing rulings on the same pairs of strings was particularly problematic. Okay, I see Jamie's got his hand up. Please, Jamie, go ahead.
Thanks, Jamie Baxter, for the record. I think what we're seeing here and in the issue we were just talking about as well is that when there does exist vagueness in what is provided in the applicant guidebook, that there perhaps would be more flexibility in the on the evaluation side, assuming that there was a reasonable interpretation of the vagueness. So I guess what I'm saying is that either it becomes more clear or the implementation of the vagueness becomes more inclusive, because when applicants only have so much information to work with when developing their application, if they have a reasonable interpretation of what that is suggesting, that needs to be taken into consideration as it's being evaluated through the implementation side of it. So, I kind of see it from either side, but unlike CPE, where there was a vagueness to it, applicants applied, and then the providers, the CPE providers, came in and decided how they were going to interpret it, which sort of stripped away some of the flexibility in the way the applicants interpreted the vagueness. So perhaps that's just a point for discussion here when we're talking about either making it more clear or leaving it vague, but allowing for a reasonable interpretation of the vagueness.
Thank you, Jamie. Okay. Anyone else want to weigh in on this? Looking through some of the CC2 comments that came in, the registry stakeholder group, the BRG, and affiliates said that community objections need to be improved. Some sample excerpts suggestion to make the cost community objections more predictable. It says, in some cases, applicants should be able to remediate impact identified in community objections. In the 2012 round, community objections were all or nothing, even if the impact to the affected community could be corrected by the applicants. The panel had no option to allow the application to proceed or to terminate it. This made the standard to win an objection quite high, quite high. And it also meant that some applications probably could have been remediated were instead rejected. So the suggestion is allow arbitrator to identify remedies or cures that would address the detriment to the community, which could be adopted by the applicant and would form a binding portion of the eventual registry agreement. Okay, so this sort of all or nothing approach of the 12 round is getting a little bit of pushback here. Anybody else have any thoughts on this? The BC suggested developing a process to appeal decisions. Both losing objectors and applicants must have standing to appeal the panel's decision, says the BC. And we propose that any review or appeals panel be comprised of arbitrators with specific demonstrated experience in new GTLD program objections. Anyone else want to weigh in on these suggestions or some of the other ones coming in? Alan, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I support what Jamie was saying, and I also, in terms of the one of the more recent comments you just read out, that the panel should be able to remediate the objection. This concept of if you have a valid thing, then the whole application dies, doesn't make a lot of sense if we're looking for predictability and organizations making reasonable investments in applying for TLDs. So I think you were referring before, or maybe one of the other commenters, the panelists should not take loose interpretations, come up with a rigid implementation without having told anyone ahead of time that's their interpretation, and then apply it. So if the rules in the guidebook are relatively loose, then the panelists have to keep them relatively loose. But the outcome should not be a pass or fail, but should look at moving forward and seeing can we address the objection and still have the application go through. So I think this whole thing needs to be rethought much more than just a minor little tweak. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And I see you looking in the chat box. You've got some support for that suggestion as well from Jamie, John, and Phil. Anybody else want to weigh in on this point, 3.1.2? Steve Chan has his hand up. Please, Steve, go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. This is Steve Chan from staff. And so in support of actually a different PDP working group, we had taken a look at the nominate dispute resolution process. And so one of the elements of that process is actually prior to the panel reaching an expert decision, they actually have a supported mediation process. And so maybe that's not quite exactly what could be in mind here, but, you know, the discussion about whether or not some outcomes besides pass or fail for the application could be envisioned. That could be something that could be considered by this group, essentially an intervening step before the panel decision is made. So an opportunity for the applicant and objector to perhaps discuss the concerns that the objector has, and maybe that there could be resolution sought before the objection actually gets to the point where panelists get involved and costs start getting incurred. Just some food for thought. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. I see Alan's got his hand up. Please, Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I support that, but that implies we and the panelists have to allow the application to be changed because of that mediation. So again, we're into under what conditions can an applicant change the terms of their application on the fly? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, does anyone else want to get in the queue on this point? All right, let's go down to the next one, 3.1.3. Do you believe there were any issues with standing requirements as in the application guidebook or as carried out by the providers? And as a reminder, the standing to object was or is such that quote, objectors must satisfy standing requirements to have their objections considered. As part of the dispute proceedings, all objections will be reviewed by a panel of experts designated by the applicable dispute resolution service provider to determine whether the objector has standing to object. And standing requirements for the four objection grounds are, and then there's a standing requirement for string confusion, existing TLD operator or GTLD applicant in the current round may object. If the objection has to do with legal rights, who may object are the rights holders. If the objection has to do with the limited public interest, who may object says no limitations on who may file, however, subject to a quick look designed for early conclusion of frivolous claims. Community objection, who may object, established institutions associated with a clearly delineated community. Okay, so that sort of lays out who has standing to object to which grounds under the AGB. So, as the question asked, do you believe there were any issues with the standing requirements? Please explain. Oh, and I see we've got a couple hands up. Anne and then Jamie. Please, go ahead, Anne.
Hi, Robin. It's Anne for the transcript. I apologize I didn't get my hand up fast enough in relation to the previous question. It has to do with a comment about, you know, when Steve was saying, hey, a possible change is there could be an intervening step in the process and the objections and trying to work out issues early on. And Alan was talking about how, you know, under what circumstances do we allow people to change their applications? And it just occurred to me at that end of that conversation that one manner that we allowed for changes in applications in the 2012 round was public interest commitments. And we're talking about, you know, community applications, generally speaking, serving the public interest. And so my thought was if we do start looking at ways that, you know, as a result of a community objection, an application could be changed, maybe it could involve some picks. I'm sorry to be late on that, but just a thought I wanted to get in the notes. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for bringing that to the back to us. Okay, next in the queue is Jamie, and then Alan.
It's Jamie.
Thanks, Jamie Bexter, for the record. I think what is important here when we talk about standing is determining standing prior to ever having to engage in an objection. I'm not quite sure why, but in the community and process, standing was only part of the overall evaluation by the panelist. Therefore, it could easily put community applicants in a position where they're defending against an objection that was never going to reach standing from the get-go. And that seems like a lot of wasted resources, time, as well as money. And so correcting that in the next round, I think, is incredibly important, that community objections or any other objection should only proceed if standing is determined to be legitimate by anybody who is with an objection.
Thanks, Jamie. Alan, please go ahead.
Thank you. Just with regard to Anne's comment, that she said the picks were a way that applications could be changed on the fly in the last round. That's true, but that's because the pick was only introduced on the fly in the last round. Presumably, if we include the concept of picks in this round, we may or may not allow them to be changed on the fly as we go forward. So that's a decision we're going to have to make, not a given, because, you know, it's the concept will have been there at day one instead of only introduced halfway through. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Anne, is that a new hand? Okay. Anne, are you, you're up. Please come in.
Sorry, no.
Okay. Greg, please go ahead.
Thanks, Greg Chatton, for the record. And I think, you know, Alan has put his finger on, you know, a couple of times, really a big issue for the entire application process. You know, it's been exposed here in the context of the community application, but the issue of whether and how applications can be changed after they're submitted, I think is something we need to put a big fat pin in and deal with directly. You know, obviously there are concerns on the other side about gaming, but, you know, if the idea is to create a flexible process and maximize the likelihood of successful applications, and also those that succeed because they're better than they started, than when they started, and that should be supported broadly. And, you know, since picks were kind of a kludge going in, we can't expect that to be that way. So I think this is kind of a bigger issue than our work track or this particular topic, and something we need to deal with overall. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Does anyone else want to get in the queue on this? I noticed in some of the comments that came in the CC2 with respect to 3.1.3 and the standing to object question, the registry stakeholder group, the BRG and affiliates, had concerns with the standing requirements for recommendation 20, which is the community applications recommendation. And they say, we believe that the administrative review process failed to weed out objections where the objection filer did not meet the conditions to establish standing to file. So this is something we've heard before, and again here, another recommendation is providing some clarity around again, this concept of what is a significant portion of the community that's referenced in Recommendation 20. Anyone else have any thoughts or suggestions on 3.1.3 and the standing to object question? Okay, I don't see any hands. Let's go to the next one. 3.1.4, do you believe there is evidence of decisions made by objection dispute panels that were inconsistent with similar objections, the original policy recommendations and or the AGB? In the comments that we received, the BC, the Registry Stakeholder Group, BRG, and affiliates pointed to evidence of inconsistencies, and it's quite a list that was provided if you read through their comments that were submitted in terms of there being a number of inconsistencies. Does anyone want to weigh in on this point, 3.1.4, and inconsistencies in dispute resolution panels? Alan, yes, please go ahead.
Just a comment that if all, and I haven't read this recently, so I may be speaking out of turn, but if all of the examples are singular and plural, then if we are covering singular and plural with an explicit rule, as has been suggested, then the fact that those objections had inconsistent results becomes a moot issue. So I think we need to separate out the answers to this question on whether they related to singular plural or whether they related to other things. Now, I know, in for instance, the case of COM and CAM, they did relate to other things now that I think about it, so we do have at least one other counterexample. But I think we need to, going forward, make sure that if we are adding a new rule because of the confusion in results to objections, that we need to exclude that when we look at whether we need to reword or change the objection process. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Anyone else want to weigh in on this point? 3.1.4 and inconsistency. Okay, not seeing any hands or hearing any voices. Let's go down to the next one, 1.1.5. Are you aware of any instances where the party or parties attempted to, quote, game the objection procedures in the 2012 round? If so, please provide examples and any evidence you may have. So it looks like we received a number of comments that provided evidence of gaming from .gay, LLC, from the Registry Stakeholder Group, Affilius. Anyone on this call want to weigh in on this question or on some of the responses that we got in the CC2, some of these examples? I know we're running short on time here, so I just want to see if we can finish up with this question here. Yes, Jamie, please go ahead.
Thanks. Jamie Baxter for the record. I think what the examples clearly show is that there was a concerted effort by some to derail community applications using the objection process. And so it really does need to be looked at very seriously. We've provided a number of recommendations as to how that could be tidied and implemented a little bit differently to prevent, again, as I said earlier, a wasting of resources, time, and money, which is incredibly important in this process. Hopefully I noticed Donna's comment about the CPE investigation that's ongoing. It is going to be looking at inconsistencies, but unfortunately it's not going to be looking at a lot of these other issues that we're now talking about with respect to gaming. So at least I'm not aware of it happening in this investigation. But, these are important things that can be used against communities or applicants who may not have the resources or may not have the capabilities to defend them off. And I encourage people to read through the examples, specifically the ones that we've included on the gaming issues, to make sure that we're all aware of what happened so that we can discuss ways to prevent it in the future. Thanks.
Thank you, Jamie. Anyone else want to weigh in on this? We're right at the top of the hour now, so if I don't see any hands or hear any voices, I'm going to suggest we wrap this discussion up for today. See, Susan has her hand up. Please, Susan, go ahead.
Yes, thanks. It was a quick question sort of on the topic generally. And I don't know if this is the right time to be asking this question or not really, but there was a proposal way back in about February from the Registry Stakeholder Group that related to string similarity and string confusion. And I was just looking back quickly at the headline notes on that proposal, and it seemed to me that it got quite a lot of support. And it was there was an idea that it would be put into a Google Doc and kind of finessed a little offline. But I'm just seeking to kind of understand what's happened with that process, because it feels like that didn't happen, but I may have missed it.
Thanks very much for that, Susan. I see Karen has her hand up. Please, Karen, go ahead.
Hi, this is Karen for the record. Hey, Susan. Yes, it did get a lot of support, and we went over it again when we did the CC2 on the strings just before Abu Dhabi. I think it was like in October. And again, it seemed to be well supported. It is on our schedule for the first of the year. And so the actual document hasn't been circulated yet. Because it's just, we haven't gotten to it yet, but it's there, and we're going to get to it. But yeah, the registry proposal is the basis of what we're sort of moving on. So it hasn't been forgotten. That helps.
Yes, thanks very much for that, Karen. Okay, does anyone else have any final thoughts, last words for today? According to my calendar, this is our last Work Team 3 meeting for the year, and so we will meet again in early January. And thank you all for participating today, and I wish you all a happy holiday season. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody, Bob.
Thank you, everyone. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.